From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Yiddish Theater in America, where Jewish immigrants brought versions of Shakespeare and Tolstoy, as well as original works, to the stage, reflecting on their own immigrant experiences. We talk with Stefan Canfer about his new book, Stardust Lost. He had relatives from the town in Romania where the Yiddish theater originated. Then we hear some Jewish novelty songs from the early 20th century, like Cohen Owes Me $97 and I'm a Yiddish a Cowboy. Jody Rosen has put together an anthology of such recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actors Paul Muni, John Garfield, Zero Mostel, and Walter Matthau, the acting teachers Lee Strasberg and Sanford Meisner, and director Sidney Lumet were all associated with Yiddish theater early in their careers. Yiddish theater was written and performed by and for Yiddish-speaking Jews, largely in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It originated in Eastern Europe. Its capital in America was the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where many Jewish immigrants lived. The Yiddish theater altered the history of Broadway and Hollywood, and thus, to a certain extent, America, writes Stefan Kanfer in his new book, Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishegas of the Yiddish Theater in America. Kanfer is also the author of books about Groucho Marx and the summer resorts of the Catskill Mountains. Kanfer has a personal connection to the Yiddish theater. The town that your grandfather was from, Iași, Romania, you described that as the place where Yiddish theater actually started. I didn't realize you could actually trace Yiddish theater to, like, one town.
That's right. You know, that nobody knows how the Greek theater began or who its father was or even how the Shakespearean Elizabethan theater started. But we know that the Yiddish theater began in a wine cellar in Iași, Romania, with a play by a man named Abraham Goldfaden, who really was sort of the George Washington of the Yiddish theater.
And so tell us about that first play.
Well, it was what he later described as a hodgepodge. He was a man who anticipated Irving Berlin by 50 years in that he couldn't read or write a note, but he could sound notes out on the piano and somebody would transcribe them. He wrote lyrics. He also wrote the books for these shows. And although they are none of them very memorable at first, they enchanted an audience who had never seen theater before. Jews were not really welcomed, certainly not in the Russian theater. And besides, the rabbis frowned upon such theater as, quote, frivolous.
So there hadn't been Yiddish theater before this play. Like, why not? I mean, there's theater all over the world. Why wasn't there Yiddish theater?
Well, before 1876, which was when it began, we really had a kind of restrictions on the Jews. Certainly, Tsar Nicholas didn't, the Romanovs in general, didn't want Jews around. They certainly didn't want them in the cities, so they were largely in what's called the Pale, these settlements far beyond the places of urbanity where theater thrived. And the Jews of France and Germany and places where they were, a little less restrictions. There were also traditions of the Jewish traditions, which didn't allow or didn't welcome Jews in theater. They felt that a Jew would become too assimilated too quickly. That was not what they wanted. They wanted Jews to remain Jews, and they would be polluted by what was called the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. But of course, there was no holding back the Enlightenment. The rabbis were King Canute in that regard, and sooner or later it had to happen. And it happened in a fairly liberal country, which Romania was then, and in a very liberal city, which was Iași.
So how did Yiddish theater spread after that first play in Iași, Romania?
It's a wonderful question because it was almost as if it were a fire waiting to be ignited. What happened was the word of mouth was so extraordinary that people began to pile into these little wine cellars, and then suddenly everyone wanted to be an actor. There were no academies for Jews who wanted to study acting, so they just invented the form of acting. They invented songs, they invented stories, they invented playwrights, and they developed the theater out of nothing almost overnight, so that by the late 19th century, it was blooming in Russia, even though there were restrictions against it, and in France, and in England, and eventually when the pogroms began to be very heavy and torturous, the Jews arrived in New York, as we know, by the millions, by the time the immigration was over. And since you cannot have a great theater without a great audience, they formed that great audience.
Then the Yiddish theater came to the United States as Jewish immigrants came to the United States and became very popular.
Yes.
In Manhattan in particular. What were some of the early narratives of the Yiddish plays in the early part of Yiddish theater in New York?
Well, believe it or not, they adored great plays. So they tried to adapt Tolstoy, and they even adapted Hamlet. And there's a wonderful story that goes along with that. Boris Tomaszewski, who is the grandfather of Michael Tilson Thomas, the conductor, was a sort of a rotund, very self-involved impresario actor. Thought the world of himself, and of course the women were crazy about him. He cut a fine figure of two men, I like to say. But in any case, he decided that he was going to do Shakespeare. He did Hamlet, probably the fattest Hamlet that ever was, and it was adored by the audience. And they applauded at opening night. And then they called, author. He was mortified because he didn't know what to do, and his wife, Bessie, pointed to one of the actors and said, "You go out and say you're Mr. Shakespeare." They spelled it S-H-E-K-S-P-I-R. Shakespeare. "You go out and say you're Mr. Shakespeare." And the actor wouldn't do it. So she came to the apron of the stage and she said, "Mr. Shakespeare lives a long way from here in London, but he's very grateful for your response." Anyway, that's the kind of theater that they had. It was originally theater, borrowed theater from other sources, and gradually they began to develop their own playwrights, some of them hacks and some of them quite brilliant.
Now, you make a distinction between the more ambitious plays and socially relevant plays in the Yiddish theater and the stuff that you describe as shund, which is Yiddish for trash. What were some of the differences between the two?
Well, they used to shoehorn songs into everything, including King Lear. There's a wonderful site. It's a true story. There's a wonderful site that Brown University has. They have all of the Yiddish theater song sheets, and they're quite beautiful, but you see that they had songs for Tolstoy's Resurrection, for example. They just shoehorned it in there. And so that even serious theater for a while had touches of shund, but the real shund was kind of vaudeville. It was, the couple meet, the couple break up, the couple finally wed under the canopy, that sort of thing with songs and stories. Whereas the real theater, with playwrights like Jacob Gordon, really discussed the hard life of Jews in the old world and then in the new world, the idea of the sweatshop, the idea of social justice, which was always burning hard in the Lower East Side, became the subject matter of many a play.
Now, some actors were unhappy having to do the more formulaic kind of Yiddish theater, and you describe in particular David Kessler, and you quote him as saying, "All day long, I am a human being. I speak like a human being, act like a human being. At night, I must dress myself like a turkey, like an idiot. If I went out in the street like this, people would throw stones at me for a lunatic. Yes. Here in the theater, they shout, 'Bravo.'" So,
well, there were three great actors. He was one of them. Kessler was a very important actor because he was a naturalist. He did not go for the breast beating and the forehead wiping that you see in so much Yiddish theater, and indeed you saw it at that point uptown in Broadway as well. He was a very serious guy, died in his middle years and left almost nothing behind. He didn't have children, so he is almost forgotten now. The second one, these are all spiritual sons really of the founder, and they're important on their own, but they would not really have happened without Abraham Goldfaden. The second is Jacob Adler, and Jacob Adler is the father of Stella Adler, the great acting teacher who taught Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro and Melanie Griffith and many, many others. And Jacob Adler was so powerful an actor that when he played Shylock, which is, after all, Shakespeare's most anti-Semitic creation, it was a tremendous sensation, not only on the Lower East Side, but a producer named Daniel Frohman came down and said, "Mr. Adler, I'd like to take this to Broadway." And Adler said, "Look, I know what I sound like when I speak English. I have a strong Yiddish accent. I'll sound like a vaudevillian and a comedian, and I'm not going to do it." And Frohman said, "You misunderstand me, Mr. Adler. You will play in Yiddish, and everyone else will play in English." And that's exactly what happened. If you can imagine such a thing happening on Broadway today, Shylock was played in Yiddish, and The Merchant of Venice, the rest of it was played by English-speaking actors speaking Elizabethan English. The third was Boris Tomaszewski, whom I've described before, but Tomaszewski was important because he got things on. He knew how to raise money. He was like Hal Prince. He just knew how to find the theater and make the presentation, and was very, very popular for a long, long time. Died broke, of course, as they tend to do.
No, I want to get back to the actor David Kessler, and he's the one who said, you know, that basically that if he looked and behaved on the street the way he did on stage, people would think he was a lunatic, but he's applauded for this on stage. He wanted to do a more naturalistic form of acting. In order to do that, he needed to find a playwright who could write plays that kind of more naturalistic acting would be suitable for. And he did find someone. Who did he find?
Well, Jacob Gordon was a more than great playwright. He was somebody who was a pioneer. He's almost forgotten now, but if you go back and you look at those plays, and I've looked at many of them, they have a sincerity and a very direct reach to the audience. They don't plead for sympathy. He's very realistic about how he handles characters, and you could see that Kessler would fall in love with this kind of dialogue. On the other hand, most of the audience didn't want to see naturalistic drama. They wanted to see the exaggerated form. Franz Kafka, who was a great Yiddish theater fan in Prague, loved the exaggerated performances. He said, one must aim high to hit the mark. And they really loved that. But Kessler was well ahead of his time in demanding believability. The others kind of hammed it up, particularly Chomyshevsky, or Pastrami did up, I guess you'd say. But he was just somebody that that had the shop girls in his corner. And Kessler never was popular. I mean, he was certainly highly regarded and respected, but he never gained the popularity that Chomyshevsky did because he played to the galleries.
In writing about the Yiddish theater, you write a bit about Sholem Aleichem, who wrote a lot of Yiddish plays and short stories. In fact, Fiddler on the Roof is based on one of his stories, Tevye the Milkman. And you quote a letter, you excerpt a letter that Sholem Aleichem, which was a pen name, by the way, wrote to the actor Jacob Adler, trying to convince him to do a Tevye story on stage. Would you read an excerpt of that letter for us?
Yes, because I think it gives a great picture of what was going on the stage at that point. It begins, "Great master of the stage, in my play you will find none of the effects on which the Jewish public has for so many years been nourished. You will find no soul-tearing scenes, no corpses in cribs, no demented women, no patriotic songs or nationalistic speeches, no transient boarders seducing innocent maidens, and no vulgar jokes. You will only find a simple Jew, father of five daughters, an honest, clean, wholesome, and greatly suffering character who, with all his misfortunes, will make the public laugh from beginning to end." Of course, he was right. That was Tevye that he's describing, but it took another 50 years before that Tevye was acceptable to the American public.
My guest is Stefan Kanfer. His new book about the Yiddish theater is called Stardust Lost. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stefan Kanfer. His new book is called Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishegas of the Yiddish Theater in America. You know, you've been talking a little bit about some of the friction within the Yiddish theater about, you know, more serious and realistic plays versus more formula, overacting, hyper-emotional kinds of things. There was also, apparently, some friction between Yiddish theater and vaudeville. From how you describe it, it sounds like a lot of people on the Yiddish stage really look down on vaudeville.
Well, I think that's been the case with Uptown as well. I think vaudeville is a place where amateurs get started. And in those days, that was the training ground for people who wanted to get into theater or wanted to get at some point into a higher show business, play two a day at the Palace Theater, for example. But it was not legitimate. And the Yiddish theater snobs that they were decided that legitimate was better than vaudeville and that you could have an Eddie Cantor, but you couldn't have a Jacob Adler on the same stage. So there was that. And they also found in vaudeville a kind of cheap, easygoing anti-Semitism. And, you know, there's a CD that's come out fairly recently called Jewface. And it plays a lot of those old playing around anti-Semitic kind of songs that were very popular on the stage. And the Yiddish theater actors were appalled by this. They took themselves seriously. They took their crowds seriously. Often the audience was more religious than the actors, but they respected the religion and they respected the idea of culture, a high culture. And they thought vaudeville, I think quite correctly, was a lower down kind of entertainment.
Yeah, and the CD you mentioned, Jewface, which is a CD of Jewish ethnic comic recordings and songs from the early part of the 20th century, we'll actually be speaking later in the show to the person who put that CD together.
Well, one of the songs is called Cohen Owes Me $97, and it's by Irving Berlin, who came from a Yiddish-speaking family and certainly was influenced by a lot of the Yiddish theater, but decided to go the other way. Gershwin was another one. George Gershwin was offered a job playing music in the Yiddish theater and composing for the Yiddish theater for Boris Tomaszewski, and Tomaszewski decided Gershwin wasn't good enough. And Gershwin thereafter used to meet Sholem Secunda, who wrote By Mir Bist Du Schön, and stayed all his life in the Yiddish theater as a composer. And he kept shaking his hand saying, thank you. If I hadn't been kicked out that day, I'd be a composer for the Yiddish theater. That's all I'd be.
Well, it's nice to live in a time where you can embrace both. You know, you can embrace, you know, the higher aspirations of the Yiddish theater and the just kind of like fun and talent of vaudeville. You don't have to choose.
It's true. It's true. But vaudeville lasted a lot longer than the Yiddish theater, in fact.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And a lot of the vaudeville stars kind of made it to movies and television. And
there's only been a couple of crossover stars, from the Yiddish theater. One of them was Paul Muni, of course. It was Muni Weisenfreund, and was a superstar in the Yiddish theater before he became an actor for the American stage and for films and an Academy Award winner and so on. And then there's people like Molly Picon, whom people remember because she was in Fiddler on the Roof. And there are very few others. Walter Matthau began as a kid. Sidney Lumet, the director, began acting as a kid and then switched over. Very, very few. The Yiddish theater was rather exclusive in its way.
You know, you mentioned that very few of the stars of Yiddish theater actually crossed over to the English stage or to American movies. But the Yiddish theater did have quite an impact on American theater and film. And you quote Marlon Brando, who studied with Stella Adler, who was the daughter of the great Yiddish actor Jacob Adler. And Brando said, if there wasn't the Yiddish theater, there wouldn't have been Stella Adler. And if there hadn't been Stella Adler, there wouldn't have been all those actors who studied with her and changed the face of theater, and not only acting, but directing and writing.
That's true. I think she, you know, she said that she had only worked with two geniuses in her life for the stage, and one of them was her father and the other was Brando. I think there are many, many stories about the two of them. One, she was teaching a class and she said, okay, your problem now, you're all chickens. And a bomb is about to hit. And you know, and do whatever you think is right. They would go around screeching and hysterically clucking, and Brando just stayed there, sitting there, pretending that he was hatching an egg. And she said, why are you doing this? And he said, I'm a chicken. What the hell do I know about bombs? You know, she knew she had somebody lively right there. I think she was a powerful influence, as was Lee Strasberg. They, of course, the two hated each other, but they both had seen Yiddish theater, and they knew there was something holy about the way the serious Jewish actors treated the theater, and they wanted to bring that into the life of the American actor. And also they wanted to take the most realistic kinds of human problems and bring them on the stage. I mean, to me, there's no doubt that Arthur Miller wrote Death of a Salesman with Jews in mind, and he allowed Joseph Bulhoff to do it in Yiddish. And when it was done in Yiddish, most people felt that was the original and that then somebody else had translated it into English, because it played so true to the familial conflicts of the period.
How else would you describe the impact that Yiddish theater had on American acting, theater, and movies?
Well, I think, for example, just one aspect, there's a man named Jack Gottlieb who wrote a book called Funny, It Doesn't Sound Jewish, and it's all about popular songs. Now, of course, you'd expect it from Irving Berlin, but Cole Porter, who was, you know, born in Indiana and who had absolutely no connection with Jews at all when he was growing up, but later on said to Richard Rodgers, I know how to write hit tunes. And Rodgers thought that was rather miraculous and said, how are you going to do that? And he said, I'll write them Jewish, by which he meant that kind of mournful tone that you sometimes hear in a song like, you'd be so nice to come home to. It's that kind of violin sound. And so I think that emanated from the Yiddish theater, those kinds of songs. And I once saw a masterclass that Casals was teaching, Pablo Casals, the cellist, and he was playing Bach's unaccompanied partita wonderfully, and then his student did it. And my ear is not good enough. It sounded to me as if the student was wonderful, and Casals said, no, 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 no. And he made him do it again. No, no. And finally he said, no, make more Jewish, by which he meant give that lamentation that you see in the Yiddish theater, that you hear in Jewish music. So I think that was a very strong influence, and of course, later on seen in Leonard Bernstein and all the popular songwriters from Gershwin and Stephen Sondheim, all of them show this. And then in the theater itself, the serious theater, once you've experienced something like Paul Muni in, say, Scarface, which so profoundly influenced Al Pacino that, 40 years later, he demanded to be in a remake. He said it was almost surrealistic, that kind of acting was so powerful. Then you know that the Yiddish theater threw a long shadow over every living actor.
Well, Stephen Kampfer, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, always.
Stephen Kampfer is the author of Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishegas of the Yiddish Theater in America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Bill & Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Yiddish Cowboys and a Yiddish Mammy. We talk with Jody Rosen about his new anthology of Jewish novelty recordings from the early 20th century. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jody Rosen is a rock critic who has gone back to early pop, way back, for his new anthology. It features 16 Yiddish dialect novelty recordings from the early 20th century. He calls the collection Jewface because, like blackface performers of the same period, the Jewish performers of this material often dressed in stereotyped ways with fake big noses and old baggy overcoats. Many of the lyrics reflect the stereotypes of the day, too, even though most of the material was written and performed by Jews for Jewish audiences. Some of the songs in this genre were written by Irving Berlin. A few years ago, Rosen wrote a book tracing the history of Berlin's song, White Christmas. Here's a track from Jewface recorded in 1908. It's called I'm a Yiddish Cowboy.
I'm a Yiddish Cowboy, sung by Edward Meeker, Edison Records. wild and woolly prairie land, lived a cowboy by the name of Levi.
Aye, aye.
He loved a blue-blood Indian maiden and came to serenade her like a tough guy. Big Chief Crawler Legs was the maiden father, and he tried to keep Levi away. Levi didn't care for every evening. With his Bronco Buster, giddy-up, giddy-up, he'd come around and say, whoa!
Tough guy Levi, that's my name, and I'm a 80s cowboy. I don't care for Tommy Hoyks or Cheyenne's Indian. Oi, oi! I'm a real lifetime and seek that shoot them till they die. I'll marry Spot, Tati Boss, or I'm a fighting guy.
Jody, how did you first discover this genre of Jewish dialect recordings from the early 20th century?
I was, about a dozen years ago, I was in graduate school in London, of all places. But I, at the time, was interested in writing something about Jewish songwriters and kind of the assimilation of Jewish immigrants. I was pretty vague about it. But I spent a lot of time in the British Library, where they had enormous sheet music holdings. And I was kind of digging through some songs one day, and I happened upon a song called I Want to Be an Oi, Oi, Oiviator, which was from, I think, 1915 or 1916, a time when there were a lot of kind of topical novelty songs about airplanes and aviation. And this was a sort of Jewish-themed variation on that. And so this really tickled me. I want to be an oi oi oiviator. I thought this was the funniest and weirdest thing I'd ever seen, and assumed it was kind of a one-off novelty. But as I began to dig deeper, I realized that this was, you know, just one of hundreds, thousands of songs that were written. That this was a full-fledged genre. That, you know, really the Jewish equivalent of blackface minstrelsy.
Well, you know, America's, like, you know, best known and perhaps most beloved songwriter Irving Berlin got started writing these ethnic songs, and you include one of them on your CD, and the song is called Cohen Owes Me $97. How many of these kinds of songs did Irving Berlin write? Like, where does it fit into his career?
He wrote lots of them. He was one of the kind of big and most successful specialists in the genre. Of course, he wrote songs in all of the ethnic genres. He did, you know, well, famously did blackface material, and did a lot of these Jewish songs. But he also, you know, wrote songs like Italian songs. His first published song was called Marie from Sunny Italy, which was written in 1907 and was an Italian number. He also wrote a number called Hey Wop, to give you a flavor of, you know, some of the language that was used in these songs. But anyway, yeah, he was something of a specialist in the Jewish stuff. So he, one of his big hits from 1909 was a song called Sadie Salome Go Home, which is about a kind of a Jewish, you know, burlesque kind of striptease dancer woman, Jewish woman. And this was the first big hit for Fanny Bryce. And then there was Cohen Owes Me $97, which he wrote several years later in 1916, which was also something of a hit. And it tells the story of Old Man Rosenthal, who's a Jewish businessman, or kind of someone in the shmata business, you know, in the clothing business, who's on his deathbed, and his kind of dying wish is to see that his son recoups his unpaid debts from other businessmen, because after all, you know, he's Jewish, and the joke is that, you know, all they care about is money. And the kind of punchline of the song is his son manages to get his $97 paid back, and then, of course, the Old Man Rosenthal miraculously rises from his deathbed and lives again. So the recording on the record is by a wonderful singer called Rhoda Bernard, and one of the joys for me in collecting this stuff has been to discover some of them real extraordinary singers who have just completely been lost to history. And I especially like Rhoda Bernard. She's got quite a big, booming voice.
Well, let's hear some of Cohen Owes Me $97, sung by Rhoda Bernard, recorded in 1916, and featured on Jody Rosen's new anthology, Jew Face, which is a collection of Jewish ethnic recordings.
Son was sitting by his bed. About the matter, Papa dear, he said. The old man said, my son, before my days are done, I want you to know. Cohen owes me $97.
Cohen Owes Me $97, written by Irving Berlin and featured on the new anthology Jewface, which is a collection of Jewish ethnic comedy recordings from the turn of the 20th century. And my guest, Jody Rosen, is the curator of the anthology. He's a music critic who writes for Slate. People will really wonder, listening to this, is this music, is it racist? Is it anti-Semitic? I mean, what is this music about? It's Jewish performers self-stereotyping. Was this common of Jewish ethnic humor at the time?
Yeah, it was. You know, this whole genre that we called Jewface on this record, at the time they were called Hebrew, they referred to as Hebrew dialect songs or Yiddish dialect novelties. These were songs that... partook of sort of age-old, somewhat virulent anti-Semitic stereotypes. The lyrical content often involves kind of money-grubbing Jews and, you know, sort of bumbling greenhorn immigrant Jews making fools of themselves. And they were typically performed on vaudeville by so-called Hebrew comedians who put on a sort of uniform, dressed up in stereotypical garb. So they wore derby caps that were pulled down tight across their head so their ears jutted out, and they had these enormous kind of fake noses that were enhanced with what was called Jew clay in the trade, you know, sort of putty. And they wore ratty overcoats, and the type they were playing was a sort of a Lower East Side, you know, pawn shop owner or rag tradesman. So it really was a sort of Jewish equivalent to blackface minstrelsy or Jewish minstrelsy act. The interesting thing about these, though, is that while they were, on the surface at least, quite anti-Semitic, they were largely written by Jewish songwriters. The songs were published by Jewish-owned song publishing firms, performed on vaudeville circuits where Jews predominated, both as, you know, kind of in the on the business end and as performers. And Jewish audiences loved them. There were campaigns organized by certain parts of the Jewish community by kind of advocacy organizations like the Central Conference of American Rabbis to try and wipe out this brand of entertainment. But there were editorials in the Jewish press that denounced these efforts because they pointed out that it was actually Jews who went and applauded and laughed and loved these things, these songs, more than anyone else.
Yeah, well, you know, in your liner notes, you quote from the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which was the Reform Movement's governing body, and you say that in the era of these songs, this group launched a nationwide campaign to, quote, drive this vile, outrageous, and undignified creature from the boards, the creature being this type of ethnic humor and the boards being the theatrical boards. This music is still controversial. There was a New York Times article about the anthology that you put together, Jewface, and in that article there was a quote from Kenneth Jacobson, the deputy national director of the Anti-Defamation League, and he said that a project like this, quote, gets very complicated. Our experience in this kind of thing is that inevitably somebody will probably use this for not such good purposes, unquote. So I'm wondering if you're at all ambivalent about, you know, putting this stuff out there again and, you know, playing it on the radio.
Yeah, I'd say slightly ambivalent, with an emphasis on slightly. And, you know, sometimes when people come over to my house, I collect not only the, you know, the 100-year-old recordings on kind of 78 discs and wax cylinders of this stuff, but I also collect sheet music, which is, you know, often very garishly illustrated sheet music with, you know, pictures of Jews with big noses and such. So it's, I guess, a bit, yes, problematic. On the other hand, this is part of history, and moreover, it's fascinating. So my ambivalence is tempered a great deal by the fact that I think it's important for both kind of Jewish history, for historians to acknowledge complicated, maybe not so morally clean-cut aspects of Jewish experience. And moreover, as a kind of music critic, and I suppose you'd call me a music historian, although I don't want to, you know, get too grand about it, I'm very interested in the issue of minstrelsy generally and the role that ethnic pastiche and impersonation and minstrelsy has played in the history of American popular music, which is an enormous role and which only, pardon me, only recently, you know, scholars have really begun to get their arms around because it's just been such, viewed as such troubling stuff. So for that reason, I'm excited to get this stuff out. I should also add that I find lots of these songs incredibly sort of catchy and charming despite of and sometimes because of their lyrical content. And so I think this stuff is important, long and short of it is, and for that reason I'm you know, proud of the record.
My guest is Jody Rosen. He compiled an anthology of Yiddish dialect novelty recordings from the early 20th century called Jewface. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jody Rosen. He's a rock critic who's curated an anthology of Yiddish dialect novelty recordings from the early 20th century called Jewface. Well, you know, the era of these like Jewish ethnic recordings is also, as you were saying, the era of minstrelsy and blackface performance. And in fact, some Jewish performers performed in blackface, like Al Jolson and Sophie Tucker. So it almost gets mind-bending to think of all of the kind of bizarre ethnic things going on in some of this music. And a great example of that is a track on your anthology, which is called My Yiddish Mammy. And would you talk a little bit about this track and how what it makes you think about?
Yeah, well, the song... this recording on the recording on the record was from 1922. It's sung by Irving Kaufman, another prominent performer of the era. It was actually co-written by three Jews, including Eddie Cantor, the great vaudevillian. And it's, of course, a parody of Al Jolson's signature tune, My Mammy, which is, you know...
Which he used to sing in blackface, right?
Which he used to sing in blackface on Bended Knee. Yeah, and it kind of is a sort of Jewish-themed twist on the whole genre of songs which pine for, you know, both the plantation and the plantation mammy figure. You know, this was the era that the nation was suddenly transformed into this kind of seething polyglot place. And there weren't only Jewish and blackface numbers. There were, you know, Italian dialect numbers. There were Irish dialect songs. There were ones that made fun of the native Yankee New Englanders. There were Chinese-themed songs, and there were frequently songs that kind of made a joke of miscegenation and kind of racial crossover of various sorts. And so this, My Yiddish Mammy is definitely a song in that mode.
Quote a verse, you know, a few lines from the song that you find particularly interesting, and then we'll play it.
I like the lyric that goes, I love my mammy, but she don't come from Alabama. Her heart is filled with love and real sentiment. Her cabin door is in a Bronx tenement. So my mammy specifically in all the songs that were about the sort of black mother figure down in Dixie, you know, sort of valorized the mother and had images of, you know, the black woman in a cabin on the plantation. And here this is kind of winked at. But at the same time, there's a kind of sincerity here because this song is sung in 1922 and you know, the kind of Jewish performer is remembering and valorizing his mother, the immigrant from the old, from the, you know, the Jewish old world.
And can I add one thing to that? That I think it's also satirical in the sense that it's an acknowledgement that for most Jewish immigrants at that time in the United States, they were urban and they were from the North and not the South. So the whole kind of like Southern mystique was alien to so many of them, not part of their experience at all.
Correct. And what's interesting is that so many prominent Jewish musicians, songwriters, and performers used that completely alien Southern black imagery to kind of get their careers kickstarted. You know, the first big hit by the Gershwins was Swanee, about the Swanee River. Irving Berlin's first huge hit, the song that made his career, was Alexander's Ragtime Bend, which of course talks about the Swanee River. And there's a famous story about Jolson, who sang, of course, about Swanee repeatedly in many songs, finally seeing the Swanee River and being, he'd imagined some sort of like gushing river of Jordan. And he got down there and he was very disappointed to see that, you know, it looked like just a little trickling creek to him.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about as we listen to this 1922 recording of My Yiddisha Mammy, which was co-written by Eddie Cantor and recorded by Irving Kaufman.
Down south where the Swanee River flows, down south and where all the cotton grows, all of the mammies they call divine come from below that old Dixon line. But let me tell you about that dear old mammy of mine. I've got a mammy, but she don't come from Alabama. Her heart is filled with love and real sentiment. Her cabin door is in a Bronx tenement. Believe me, my mammy never heard about dear old Black Joe. She's never been down where the sweet magnolias grow. She don't play a banjo or ukulele, but her lullaby is Ailey, Ailey. That's why I love my Yiddish mammy.
That's My Yiddisha Mammy. We'll talk more with Jody Rosen about compiling his anthology of Yiddish dialect novelty recordings after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jody Rosen, rock critic for Slate magazine. He's put together an anthology of Yiddish dialect novelty recordings from the early 20th century called Jewface. Like blackface material of the same era, the lyrics have a lot of stereotypes from the period. For instance, one of the tracks on Jewface is called When Mose with His Nose Leads the Band. Before we hear it, let's see what Rosen would like us to listen for.
The song was written and recorded in 1906. It was written by a trio of Irish songwriters and recorded by a prominent vocal duo of the period, one of the most prolific recording duos of the acoustic era, of the recording era that preceded the advent of electric recording, called Collins and Harlan. They were kind of blackface specialists, but this was their one, as far as I know, their one recorded Jewish turn. The song tells the story of a kind of Jewish John Philip Sousa style band leader whose nose is so big that he uses it as a conductor's baton. It's historically pretty significant because the first six notes of the chorus of the song are identical to the first six notes of the Irving Berlin song God Bless America. And my theory is Berlin, who was at that time Israel Baleen, he hadn't yet changed his name, was an 18-year-old singing waiter at a saloon in Chinatown, in New York City, heard the song and performed it as a singing waiter. It was his job as a singing waiter to kind of keep up with vaudeville hits and interpolate them into his little act and sing them for his patrons. And so my theory is that he knew this song, and some 12, a dozen years later, when he was, you know, a millionaire songwriter and first sat down to write God Bless America, he subconsciously, I believe, lifted the notes straight out of the When Moe's With His Nose Leads the Band chorus and inserted it right into the beginning of God Bless America, the part that goes, God bless America, forgive my singing. We hear those exact same notes in the chorus, the beginning of the chorus of When Moe's With His Nose Leads the Band. The lyric there is, A, B then starts to play.
Well, here it is, When Moe's With His Nose Leads the Band.
Down our way every day there's a band. Life is gay when they play music grand. When the noisy big bass drum with their noisy tum tum tum, loud enough to wake up nearly all the land. Happy Moe's, he just shows all he knows. When he leaves, others sing in report. No baton does Moe's use, but to think he was refused. He's unique with nothing else but just his own. Baby then starts to play,
plays all day.
Oh, then says, sound your A,
peep-a-ray.
My yells, I want to play,
we shall play.
He knows all that grand.
The regular theater.
Then they'll start in to blow.
Not their dough.
Sweet things we all do know.
And right I go.
Oi, 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 but you stop. When Moe's with his nose leads the band.
Okay, that's a 1906 recording, When Moe's With His Nose Leads the Band, from the anthology Jewface, which was curated by my guest Jody Rosen. Jody, you put this together at a time, and we're listening to this at a time when I think Americans are really trying to figure out where is the line between like self-deprecating humor and racism. And I'm thinking in particular, or anti-Semitism, I'm thinking in particular here of like the Borat movie, which is probably in a category all by itself. But, you know, as everybody knows now, Sacha Baron Cohen is Jewish, and he uses a lot of anti-Semitic humor within the movie and used it within the Ali G show for his character Borat to mock anti-Semitism, not to be anti-Semitic. But it still upsets a lot of people. And I guess the best example of that is his song Throw the Jew Down the Well, which was sung on the Ali G show. Borat sung that on the Ali G show. It was actually recorded at a bar for the program. And the chorus is, throw the Jew down the well so my country can be free. You must grab him by the horn, then we have a big party. What's your reaction listening to this, given that you've been trying to find these, you know, early 20th century ethnic Jewish humor recordings? For 10 years you've been doing this.
Well, you know, there's an interesting connection, because Sacha Baron Cohen with Borat is portraying a kind of, you know, newly arrived greenhorn immigrant who's mangling the English language and kind of bumbling around the country, misapprehending the customs and getting himself into all kinds of trouble in the process. Now, of course, Sacha Baron Cohen's act is this wonderful, deeply satiric and very politically pointed postmodern act, which is a world away from what the vaudevillians were doing. Sacha Baron Cohen, he's obviously sort of using that song, Throw the Jew Down the Well, to expose anti-Semitism and to indict anti-Semites. What the Jews who sang songs like Cohen Owes Me $97 and, you know, I'm a Yiddish Cowboy and Under the Matzah Tree and these other funny, crazy songs that are on the Jewface compilation, they were, generally speaking, newly arrived Jewish immigrants, or kind of first-generation naturalized Jewish Americans. And they had a kind of precarious social status. And this was a time in the country, you know, the kind of melting pot progressive era, when there was an enormous amount of social pressure to assimilate, and indeed, a huge desire on the part of so many immigrants, especially Jews, to assimilate and kind of cast off their, you know, the kind of trappings of their old world identity and become American. And what I think is very interesting about these songs is that, you know, the audience and the performers kind of use them because in sending up the greenhorn Jew, the old world Jew, by laughing at that Jewish type, the audience is kind of asserted their own Americanness and their sophistication and the fact that they'd passed out of their own greenhorn phase and the fact that they were now themselves, you know, a different kind of, you know, American Jew.
Well, Jody Rosen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jerry.
Jody Rosen is rock critic for Slate Magazine. He curated the new CD of Yiddish dialect novelty recordings called Jewface. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilag, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Come and hear the Yiddish of Professor Mr. A.B. Cohn, A.B. Cohn. Come and hear him tickling the piano in a first-class Yiddish tone. I would never kiss him on the lips, but I'd kiss him on the fingertips. Oy, such a much is the touch that lingers. In his Yiddish fingers, he can make a second-hand piano sound the same as new. And more yet too.
Support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, National Book Award-winning novelist Robert Stone. He's written a memoir about the 60s, when he experimented with hallucinogenics and was friends with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.